Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We're going to take up one oral argument, and after that we'll take a short recess for a panel change. Your panel for this case, we are privileged today to have visiting Justice Michael Massengale, who is seated to my left, Justice Elizabeth Kerr to my right, and I am Lee Gabriel. So we will proceed with the first case, if the clerk will call the case.
The court will now call City of Fort Worth versus Kay O'Neill. And may it please the court, Ms. Kelly Madrid to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Matt Backup to argue for the appellant.
All right, Ms. Madrid.
May it please the court. We are here because the city is asking this court to reverse the district court's decision granting Mr. O'Neill's plea to the jurisdiction, and for this court to join its sister courts in holding that when a hearing examiner in a civil service appeal gathers facts relevant to the case outside of the hearing and cites to those facts in her decision, the statutory basis for appealing that decision has been met. The city property.
She just has to cite to it. Don't those facts have to procure an unlawful award?
And Your Honor, I will cover that in depth later on in the argument. But yes, the courts that have looked at this have determined that when there's a relevant fact and it's included in that opinion, that shows that the decision has been procured by unlawful means.
I'm struggling with the whole idea that what she cited about the Lipitor was even relevant, because there was one sentence about it, and then I don't recall seeing anything else in that very lengthy award that suggested to me that anything about her decision involved the fact that Mr. Woods might have bled more or less because he was on Lipitor. So can you explain how it's a relevant fact?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue before the hearing examiner was not just whether or not the altercation between Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Woods resulted in an injury. She was also making a determination as to how the altercation started, who the aggressor was, if it was merely a slap, a defensive slap, or if Mr. Woods was aggressively struck by Mr. O'Neill, what the injuries were that resulted, and what the severity of those injuries were. And so Mr. Woods was asked whether or not he took Lipitor in the hearing. He confirmed that he did. There were no follow-up questions about whether or not he had any side effects from taking Lipitor, whether Lipitor caused him to have nosebleeds specifically. None of that was included in the hearing. So ultimately, the hearing examiner concluded that Mr. O'Neill's strike of Mr. Woods was a defensive slap, and that the injury sustained were not all the result of that strike. So the reason that the Lipitor is relevant is that she went outside of the record and found these facts about Lipitor from the internet, and she states that Lipitor caused nosebleeds. That's the fact that she gathered outside of the hearing. And the parties never had the opportunity to challenge whether or not, number one, that was true of Lipitor, number two, whether or not it affected Mr. Woods generally, and third, whether or not it affected him in this case in terms of the injuries he sustained.
Did your pleadings include the argument that this reliance on the extraneous evidence was not only evidence that the order was procured by unlawful means, but that particular allegation also indicates that the arbitrator exceeded her jurisdiction?
Those are actually two distinct arguments.
I understand. That's why I'm asking, did you make both?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Both were included in the initial pleadings.
The briefing focuses more on this concept of procuring the order by unlawful means, and I can understand that since there are cases that address that. But to me, it seems like a more natural connection between the argument and the text of this statute to argue that what the arbitrator did in what you're challenging exceeded her jurisdiction in light of 143.010 G, which expressly says that only evidence submitted at the hearing can be considered. Would that be a plausible way of resolving this?
I think it certainly can be. I think procured by unlawful means is a way a hearing examiner can exceed her jurisdiction. There are other ways, and a second way, which was addressed in the briefing, is when they add a requirement that is not contained within the statute. That deals with the perceived deficiencies in the investigation that the hearing examiner cited.
Okay, so are you avoiding the argument I'm suggesting, which is that reliance on the evidence outside the record about the effects of Lipitor was outside of the arbitrator's jurisdiction because the statute specifically requires that she only consider evidence submitted at the hearing?
I agree with that, Your Honor. Okay. I do believe that that is a way in which she could have exceeded her jurisdiction. She acted contrary to the Act, which clearly states that a hearing examiner can only consider information that is presented within the hearing. And in this case, she did not do that. The hearing examiner's authority, of course, to hear Mr. O'Neill's case stems from Chapter 143 of the Texas Local Government Code, the Civil Service Act. The hearing examiner was required to act within the boundaries of her legislative grant of authority. She did not. The Civil Service Act lays out rules that a hearing examiner or civil service commission must follow and the grounds on which an appeal may be properly brought to district court. The city appealed the decision to district court for two reasons: that the hearing examiner procured her opinion by unlawful means when she gathered the relevant facts about Lipitor outside of the hearing, and also that she exceeded her jurisdiction to the extent she felt compelled to issue a reinstatement based on a perceived deficiency in the internal investigation. Now, as I stated a moment ago, the case before the district court was appealing Mr. O'Neill's termination from the Fort Worth Fire Department after the altercation that Mr. O'Neill had with a citizen, James Woods, at a TCU scrimmage. And again, the hearing examiner was not just tasked with whether or not this altercation occurred. There was no dispute that it had happened. The fire chief had alleged in the charging instrument where he terminated Mr. O'Neill that Mr. O'Neill had sucker punched Mr. Woods, that the Mr. O'Neill was not acting in defense of his children, but that this was an aggressive attack on Mr. Woods. And so the hearing examiner had to consider who started the fight, what the injuries were, and whether or not the injuries were all the result of Mr. O'Neill's strike, which is what the fire chief believed and included in his charging letter.
Do you think that the hearing examiner, as part of that, could look at least her conclusion that the fire chief basically short-circuited the investigation and just accepted one or two statements and didn't interview any witnesses or allow other witnesses to be interviewed before deciding on the indefinite suspension?
Do I think she could have considered that issue?
Yes.
Yes, I think she certainly could have taken it into consideration. And that goes to the second issue in this case of whether or not she exceeded her jurisdiction. And to the extent she felt she was required to reinstate him as a result of what she perceived as deficiencies in the investigation. We believe that that exceeded her jurisdiction because the statute only contains one process violation where reinstatement is required on the part of a civil service commission or a hearing examiner. And that is when the allegations are not included in the charging instrument against the firefighter or police officer, which was not the case here. That was not an issue in this case.
Why wouldn't that just be an error of legal judgment as opposed to something that was outside her jurisdiction? If I understand your argument correctly, what she did was something she had the discretion to do. She was just wrong in thinking that she was compelled to reach that conclusion.
That's correct. And again, we're here on a plea to the jurisdiction that was granted in Mr. O'Neill's favor. So we believe that at a minimum, the district court had the jurisdiction to hear the case because the statutory basis for appealing the decision of the hearing examiner were met for two reasons: procuring the decision by unlawful means when she went outside of the record, and secondly, to the extent she exceeded her jurisdiction by feeling compelled to reinstate Mr. O'Neill.
But what she did was not something that was, not permitted as a remedy. So it didn't exceed her jurisdiction in that way. You're just saying that she had the wrong legal standard in mind to reach a lawfully permitted conclusion or remedy.
That's correct. And the Tyler Court of Appeals had to consider a similar issue in the McAvoy case, where there the hearing examiner had determined that because what they believed were deficiencies in how the internal process terminating the police officer were handled, that hearing examiner felt they had to reinstate. And the Tyler Court of Appeals reversed that decision, finding that she was exceeding her jurisdiction because she was tacking on a requirement that's not in the statute for the department.
But she doesn't say in her award, I am reversing this indefinite suspension because I'm required to because his due process rights were violated. She says, first, the charges are not true, and this, and as a result, this is my decision. So, had she said, I'm required to reverse this because his due process rights were violated, and that's why I'm doing it, maybe we'd see this differently. But, she found the charges not to be true.
You're correct, Your Honor, in the sense that it would have been much clearer that she exceeded her jurisdiction had she come out and said, I feel like the statute requires me to reinstate as a result. It is not that clear.
Well, aren't you requiring us then to infer what she really had in mind when she wrote her award?
No. At a minimum, I think it creates a fact issue that makes the plea to the jurisdiction, the granting of the plea to the jurisdiction, an error. And we are asking that the district court's decision to do so be reversed.
You're saying the district court could resolve a fact issue as to what she was thinking when she wrote that?
I believe that the district court could have resolved, because it's the plea to the jurisdiction is the, there are some factual determinations that have to be resolved in order to grant or deny a plea to the jurisdiction in this case. And so when there's a fact issue, the plea to the jurisdiction shouldn't be granted, and the party should have the opportunity to present their cases. Mr. O'Neill argues that because the issue of the nosebleed was resolved in the city's favor, that it doesn't really matter that she went outside of the record, that the hearing examiner went outside of the record to get information about Lipitor. But I think that is misleading, because ultimately the hearing examiner did not believe the chief's allegations in the charging letter, specifically about the nature of the strike, that is, whether or not it was defensive or whether it was an aggressive sucker punch, as the chief had characterized it. And she also did not believe that all of the injuries were sustained as a result of the strike. So, again, that is why it was so improper for her to go outside of the record and look up information about Lipitor. It was not presented in the hearing, and it was relevant in resolving issues that were germane to the case, which had to do with how the injury occurred and how severe it was. The Austin Court of Appeals has considered a similar issue in Gish versus City of Austin, and there the Austin Court of Appeals said, and I'm quoting, courts have determined that a hearing examiner or commission's consideration or acceptance of evidence outside of the hearing shows procurement of that decision by unlawful means. And in that case, the case before the Austin Court of Appeals was a situation where the hearing examiner had received evidence outside of the hearing, but in that case, unlike here, the hearing examiner did not choose to cite to those facts in the written opinion. Therefore, there was a fact issue in that case as to whether or not the opinion had been procured by unlawful means, because there was no citation to the outside evidence in the opinion. Here, the hearing examiner chose to include the facts about Lipitor in her decision and cite to the internet source within the opinion.
If that sentence did not appear in this award, would we be here?
Yes, Your Honor, because there are other cases where decisions have been set aside by either a hearing examiner or civil service commission based solely on the fact that either the hearing examiner or commission accepted or sought outside information and did not rely on information presented in the hearing as the statute requires them to.
Well, I guess I'm thinking if she hadn't made a reference to it in the award, we would have no idea that she had looked it up.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the Gish case, for example, there were statements that were summarized within the city's closing brief that was submitted to the hearing examiner that were not admitted in the hearing. But because they weren't cited, there was a fact issue as to whether or not they had been relied on. But here we know that she included them in her opinion and cited to the internet source. In Steubing versus City of Killeen, the parties there had also acknowledged that when a hearing examiner goes outside of the record, that decision has been procured by unlawful means. May I have just another minute to conclude?
I tell you what, you're going to have rebuttal. We'll give you you'll have that opportunity then.
Okay.
Okay? Thank you very much. Mr. Backup?
May it please the court. The Civil Service Act says that hearing examiner decisions on these disciplinary appeals are final unless the examiner makes a jurisdictional error or the award was procured by unlawful means. As the court has seen, the city pleaded both theories in the trial court. The trial court found that neither of those grounds invoked the court's jurisdiction and dismissed the case. And so this court reviews that de novo. The question is, do either of those two theories fit within the judicial appeal statute?
Okay, so her argument is that the chief found it was a sucker punch, the hearing officer found it was a defensive slap, but could support the bloody nose by use of her independent research on Lipitor causing more bleeding. So why wouldn't that be relevant?
Well, that is the city's take, Your Honor. Unfortunately, that's not supported by the record. As the court has seen, the reference to Lipitor and the side effects are limited to that one sentence. Woods admitted he took aspirin and Lipitor. They may cause unusual bleeding. Lipitor may also specifically cause nosebleed, period. What she said about the strike being defensive was all premised on the character of the contact, that it was backhanded, that it was with Mr. O'Neill's left injured arm that he was off work and getting workers' compensation benefits for. And what she said about the cause of the injuries specifically connected them to Mr. O'Neill shoving him. You know, she says the injuries reported by Woods show that it was impossible for him to...
Okay, well, so everybody agrees the injuries were caused by Mr. O'Neill's physical contact with Mr. Woods. But the question is, were the charges that the chief made correct in that it was a sucker punch, or was it a defensive physical contact, as the hearing officer said it was? And the Lipitor supports what she says, does it not?
I don't believe it does. I think the only way the Lipitor connects to any of those issues is that the EMT that responded said that he observed a very slight nosebleed. The hearing examiner attributes that to Mr. O'Neill shoving. And so the only way it's relevant was decided in the city's favor. And so to say that an award in Mr. O'Neill's favor was procured by that one sentence just is not supported by the record.
What about the alternative path of saying that the very fact that she went outside the record and specifically noted evidence that was not part of the hearing was an act that exceeded her jurisdiction because the statute specifically forbade her from doing that?
And Your Honor, I think that would have been a potentially viable claim if the city had pleaded it. I think counsel was incorrect. The city plainly did not plead it. The medication side effect issue is limited to an unlawful procurement claim. The exceeds jurisdiction claim is specifically limited to this due process issue. And as the court knows, under Bland ISD versus Blue, jurisdiction has to be determined from the face of the pleadings. And that's just not a claim that was pleaded in this case.
Okay, so does that mean that it's something that could be remedied by an amended petition?
Potentially, the jurisdictional issue could be remedied by amending and adding that claim, and then, you know, you'd have dispositive motion. I still think that would eventually fail on the merits, but
right, but it, you acknowledge that that is a potential entryway to the jurisdiction of the district court to review what happened in the hearing.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Did the city ask in the district court to amend its petition?
It did. The city also has a backup argument on the unlawfully procured claim, arguing that the mere facts that this one sentence appeared in the award means that the award was procured by unlawful means, even if it didn't influence the outcome at all. And there's a number of problems with that. First, that claim is also not pleaded. The unlawfully procured claim, you know, states, quote, the hearing examiner's reliance on information procured outside the hearing denied the city its right to a fair hearing. And so this automatic reversal isn't pleaded, but it's also not supported by the language of the statute or the case law. You know, the statute says the award can be set aside if it's procured by unlawful means. You know, Justice Gabriel asked about this. Procure means to bring about. If this one sentence didn't bring about the ruling, then the award wasn't procured by unlawful means, just as a matter of how the English language works. And the cases bear this out. There's only four cases on evidence received outside of a hearing. In each of those, it's clear that the awards were overturned because the evidence actually influenced the result. We only have one Texas Supreme Court case. It's Richardson versus Pasadena, and that case tells us the standard. The court said that looking at evidence outside the hearing allows the decision to be set aside, quote, only when a decision is influenced by evidence of which one party has no knowledge or has no chance to confront and explain. So in that case, a police officer was fired after refusing a polygraph. The issue was whether he was ordered to take the polygraph or just asked. Only the officer and the police chief testified at the hearing. After the hearing, the city sent affidavits from three officers swearing that the police chief gave an order. The commission ruled in favor of the police chief and the city, and the Supreme Court set that aside, saying this bore directly on the central fact issue and affected the resolution of a disputed fact issue. The second case, Galveston Civil Service Commission versus Bonds. The commission got the entire packet of the city's evidence before the hearing, reviewed it before the hearing, and then ruled in favor of the city. The Houston court said that influenced the outcome and set aside the decision. Steubing versus Killeen, which counsel mentioned, the parties there agreed that the award was procured by unlawful means. When you look at the record, it's easy to see why. This is a police officer who got drunk and shot her service weapon into her bedroom wall 12 times during an argument with her boyfriend. At the hearing, she says, I'm in therapy, and that's part of the reason I should be temporarily suspended instead of fired. The hearing examiner went out and looked up studies and statistics that he said showed that therapy doesn't work for police officers. And he cited that in his award as a reason that she should stay fired. And again, the parties agreed that that influenced the outcome, and so that award was procured by unlawful means. And the last case is Gish versus City of Austin. That was a police officer fired for excessive force against a suspect. After the hearing, the city submitted to the hearing examiner the award from the appeal of another officer who was also fired for the same incident. And that award contained descriptions of the evidence from the other case. The hearing examiner ended up ruling in favor of the city. The employee sued, saying this award was procured by unlawful means because the city submitted that award from the other case. And the quote that Ms. Madrid read from that case was dicta. Actual holding is that there was a fact issue on whether the award was procured on unlawful means. And the court said whether it was cited in the award is not determinative. What matters is, quote, whether the opinion was procured through consideration of the evidence submitted outside the hearing. And so there is no case that holds that if a hearing examiner looks at something outside of a hearing and it does not influence the ultimate conclusions, then it's subject to automatic reversal.
So you don't think that the mere fact that the hearing examiner saw fit to include that reference to Lipitor would allow us or anybody to infer that she did rely on it in some form or fashion?
I don't think the mere inclusion in the recap portion, when it's not mentioned, alluded to, anything suggested about it in the analysis portion, is enough to say that the award was procured because of the one sentence.
But is it enough to raise a fact issue?
No, I don't believe there are any fact issues. I don't know how that would be determined. You know, the city has said our case is based on the face of the award. You know, that there was an opportunity for discovery. There was, you know, no DWQ, no deposition of the hearing examiner. That's not coming. You know, all the evidence is here. I don't think there's any fact question to be determined. This is just a question of law. What does the face of the award tell us? I want to take a little bit and talk about the second claim that the hearing examiner committed a jurisdictional error by creating this inapplicable rule that a firefighter has to be automatically reinstated every time there's a problem with the investigation that leads up to the termination. You know, the examiner didn't really say that that's what she was doing. And the closest she came to saying that is that the violation of Mr. O'Neill's due process rights was sufficient to overturn the indefinite suspension. So there's two main problems with trying to turn that sufficiency sentence into a vehicle to overturn this award. First and foremost, the city ignores the portion of the award that directly follows. I think Justice Gabriel mentioned this. You know, the subject heading right after that sentence says, the charges are not true. And that's followed by four pages of analysis about why the arbitrator found the charges to be not true. And the statute requires a hearing examiner to reinstate an employee when the charges are not true, and that's section 143.053G. And so any discussion of this due process issue was immaterial because this hearing examiner would have exceeded her jurisdiction if she did not reinstate Mr. O'Neill after finding the charges untrue, because that would have violated the statute's mandate. And second, even if she had relied exclusively on a due process issue to reinstate Mr. O'Neill, that's explicitly allowed by the Fort Worth Civil Service Commission. The statute requires the creation of an administrative body in each covered city that's called the Civil Service Commission. It has three members, each of whom is appointed by the city manager. And the commission's role is to oversee the administration of the statute in that city. And it has the authority to adopt rules to accomplish that function. And the Fort Worth Commission has adopted a rule stating that in disciplinary appeals to hearing examiners, due process can be a case determinative issue. That's rule 13.090. It's quoted in the hearing examiner's award on page 16 of the clerk's record, and it's on the commission's website where the court can take judicial notice of it. And we've been pointing out this local rule and arguing that it's fatal to the city's second appeal point ever since we were in the trial court. The city has never once offered a substantive response. And so on this second claim, the idea that the hearing examiner engaged in automatic reinstatement as a due process penalty is just not supported by the language of the award. Even if it was, that wouldn't exceed her jurisdiction under the act as implemented by the local body responsible for that and appointed by the Fort Worth city manager. And so the second appeal point should be rejected as well. Judgment of the district court that it lacks jurisdiction over the city's lawsuit should be affirmed, and unless the court has further questions, I'll shut up and sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Drew?
Your Honors, what Mr. O'Neill is asking this court to do is allow hearing examiners to gather relevant information outside of a hearing and rely on those in their opinions with impunity. And that simply violates Chapter 143, which clearly sets out the parameters that a hearing examiner has to operate under. And it expressly prohibits them from doing exactly what this hearing examiner did. And whether or not the medication is relevant, I think it clearly is relevant to the issue of injury and whether or not it was a severe injury. She essentially gives an alternative theory as to what could have caused this bleeding in the medication Lipitor, and those facts about the medication were not presented at the hearing.
So it was. But wasn't the dispute really, I mean, if you're going to talk about a factual dispute, wasn't it whether there was a sucker punch to the face versus a backhanded slap? Isn't that really what she was called upon to decide?
That was part of it, yes, Your Honor. And she also was looking at whether or not the strike itself caused the injuries and whether or not it caused the injuries to be as severe as Mr. Woods reported them. She was considering all of that when she was looking at this issue. And she did not find in the city's favor on those issues, contrary to Mr. O'Neill's position. So
let me ask, this may have been asked, but I want to be clear that I understand. Did you plead that considering evidence outside the record exceeds the jurisdiction? Did you actually plead that?
No. We pled that looking at evidence outside of the record is a basis for appeal under the statute because it meets the procured by unlawful means standard.
So you can't put those two things together under your pleadings. You've got a claim that she exceeded her jurisdiction. You've got a claim that she considered evidence outside the record. But you didn't put those two together, so that's not something we can consider, is it?
It has not been pled that way, Your Honor. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
But the case law that discussed the procured by unlawful means does not say procured by unlawful means, therefore exceeded jurisdiction. The case law has found that going outside of the record is procuring the decision by unlawful means, which is a statutory basis for appeal. So the district court had jurisdiction for that reason, and that would be consistent with the cases that have considered the issue.
One other question that I had based upon on something that Mr. Backup said. When I asked you earlier about her finding that the charges were not true, you said that the only thing the statute required reinstatement for were if the charges weren't alleged in the charging letter. He said that if she found the charges to be untrue, reinstatement was required. Which one is it?
The only statutory basis that requires a hearing examiner or commission to reinstate as a remedy is when the allegations are not contained in the charging letter.
So the citation that he gave us, it said if she finds the charges not to be true, it requires reinstatement, is incorrect?
I don't agree with that.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. And again, at a minimum, there is a fact issue, which means that the plea to the jurisdiction should not have been granted at the trial court level. And if the Court of Appeals reverses the district court based on the fact that she procured the decision by unlawful means, that would be consistent with other appellate courts that have already looked at this issue and can affirm that hearing examiners may not engage in the conduct that this hearing examiner did, and to do so makes the renders the decision unlawful, and it should be set aside based on that those grounds. There are no other questions.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, counsel, we very much appreciate your argument. I think it's been very helpful here today in your briefing. And your case is now submitted, and we're going to take a short recess for a panel change, and another panel will be back in just a moment.